Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I come to you live alternate Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Tonight's show, June 15th, 2011, is about an issue central to millions of couples all around the world: sex and marriage. Are they compatible long term? Joining me as my guest is Judith Rowan, a psychologist specializing in women's issues and couples therapy, and a certified sex therapist who has a practice in Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Susan.
I'm so glad you're with me tonight. I've really been looking forward to this show with you.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too. I know you've got a lot of experience in couple work, and I'm interested in your thoughts, and I'll be very interested to see what listeners have to say out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully we already have one listener on the line, and hopefully we'll have more. And I hope people will be courageous enough to call in with questions, because I don't know about you in your practice, but in my practice, I experience questions and dilemmas all the time about sexual issues. So I think we're right on target with this subject. Before we begin, one brief technical issue, and callers, don't mind me, my allergies, my as yet undiagnosed allergy is acting up. So if I'm coughing and spitting up and making wheezing sounds, I'm not dying. It's just seasonal allergies. But anyway, one brief technical issue. Listeners, your toll-free call-in number, as you're probably aware, is 877-497-9046. And I'm telling you that just in case you get disconnected, you have the number at hand to call back in on. All callers will be muted until you have a question or a comment. If so, press the 1 key on your telephone to raise your hand, and you'll be in line to join us live on the air. And Judith, I'm wondering, would you like us to leave it open and just take questions as we go, for the different issues we'll be talking about, or would you rather save it to the last 10 or 15 minutes?
No, I'm happy to get questions as they come along, if that's all right with you. I mean, I've not done this with you before, so you know better how it goes.
Okay. Yeah, it seems to me that can be more fluid, because I think what happens is we'll be talking about a subject and somebody might have very strong feelings about it or a very pertinent question, and they might forget it by the time we go on to something else.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, why don't we do that? So if anyone has a question, just press the 1 key and you'll be online to be on the air. So, Judy, how could you tell our listeners, you're a sex therapist and a couples therapist, and it's some people think it's kind of an unusual occupation, and I'm wondering how it was that you came to be a sex therapist.
Well, I always tell people it's my revenge on my upbringing. I came from a family that didn't talk a lot about sex, and I didn't know anything about sex, and had to start reading books. I mean, that's what I liked to do as I got older and went through all these years of schooling. And at the same time, Masters and Johnson were coming out with some very interesting work. And so I kind of evolved along with the field, answering my own questions and realizing that I was not alone by any means. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed to be a natural fit. And you've seen me. I kind of look like Betty Crocker. Pretty wholesome looking. So I get away with asking people a lot of very personal questions, and they don't take offense.
Yeah.
You know, they can see that I'm really interested and I mean well. So it seems to be a nice fit between a lot of questions out of my own background and my personality and the need in the larger community. So I think it, you know, it all evolved well over time. And,
right.
And I've stuck with it, unlike some people, because it's always interesting. It is unvaryingly interesting. This
oh, absolutely.
Field. I don't see why more people aren't doing this work.
Yeah, anyway. You're, I don't know if you're aware, I think you're just about the only show in town for at least 60 miles in every direction.
Actually,
I don't know,
only,
first of all.
Certified sex therapist in the state.
In the state.
Yeah.
So you have a corner on the market here.
Isn't that a shame, though?
Yeah. And I would imagine, I don't know about sex therapy as a field, but is it heavily skewed toward men? Is it rare that a woman will be a sex therapist?
Not so much now. Women have been taking over all these fields, especially as we've been paid less and less and less.
Yeah. So it's more evenly divided now?
Yeah, it used to be much more male. It used to be much more medical. But over time, women and the more psychosocial end has risen to more prominence.
Mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners' sake, could you explain what exactly the difference is between sex therapy and couples therapy?
Yeah, sex therapy is more focused on sexual problems per se. And sex therapy really is biopsychosocial. Whereas couples therapy doesn't have to focus so much on the bio part, the biological part of problems. But sex therapy, we really keep that, three focus right in front of our eyes, that we need to know anatomy, physiology, all that's happening in the current world of hormones and medications and people's physical problems and how that impacts their well-being, and especially their sexual functioning. And then, you know, the couple relationship and what's going on there, the individual intrapsychic stuff, the social context. So, you know, as I said before, it's a very interesting field to work in. You know, couples therapy is complicated enough.
I think so. I would agree with you there.
So adding the biological just gives it a little bit sharper focus, I think, and people present with more specific problems. These days, as a lot of women come in talking about pelvic pain, a lot of men, thanks to the advertising for Cialis, Levitra, so are talking more openly about erectile problems, premature ejaculation, delayed ejaculation, those kinds of things, and everybody's talking about lack of desire.
Yeah. That's
common.
Not just menopausal women who are angry and disenchanted with their husbands.
No.
Okay, because I see
no.
it a lot in that demographic.
Absolutely. There's another large group right after the first or second child.
Mm-hmm.
Women physically are exhausted, and the last thing they need to have is another adult wanting something from their body. You know, they've already given out, especially if they're nursing and they've got toddlers clamoring over them all day long. All that they want at the end of the day is to reclaim their physical self, their body space, and have a little free time. Maybe even, you know, sleep, that would be exciting for them.
Yeah. And it's, in my experience working with couples, that's often a big surprise, a bad surprise, that one of the byproducts of having, especially a first child, is that scenario that the woman is played out and just not interested, just completely engrossed in all the physiologic and emotional aspects of parenting an infant. So, you know, people are a little horrified to discover that as an issue that emerges.
Yeah. There's another group that can be very upsetting for everyone, and that's women who started off their sexual careers, if you can call it that, their sexual lives, have either as a result of sexual assault, sexual abuse, or peer pressure to be sexually involved before they were really ready, or wanting to fit in, you know, win love and attention through sex, or as a result of drugs or alcohol. They start having sex before they're really, well, before they've made up their minds that they're ready to do this. And then that group often goes on later on to stop having sex when they find somebody that they really fall in love with, who is devoted to them, who's really on their side. The rules change, they see things differently, and they lose sex, interest in sex with the one person who really thinks that they're there for her.
Yeah.
It's very confusing for everyone.
So sex doesn't serve the same function that it did earlier on, where they might have used sex as a way to act out, or as sex as a way to rebel, or sex as a way to desperately feel good about themselves or gain love. When they, ironically, as they feel more, you're saying, more settled into a relationship and safer, they don't need sex in the same kind of compulsive ways.
Yeah. Also, they start to develop a more authentic base for their life. And that's often where sex therapy comes in, developing more authentic base for their sexual lives, realizing that they have choice, that they're entitled to having a sexual identity too, exploring what that might be, what they want to have that look like, how they express that with a partner.
Okay.
So, you know, we're busy reframing things. You know, going from sexual abuse and sex is awful and blah, 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 don't want it anymore, you know, this, despite the fact that I'm with somebody who really loves me, to, okay, so now you're in a better situation. What is it that you would like to have in your life? You know, apparently you're going to be sexually active. That's the hope and dream and the expectation here that your partner has. What about you? What would you like to have if you're going to be a sexually active person?
Right. So obviously, developing a sense of self and voice are, it sounds like you're saying, really critical to moving toward a good, enduring sexual relationship. I mean,
absolutely.
It sounds like, you know, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I guess my one question I have for you is whether or not, sort of two questions paired, Do you feel that a good sex life in a long-term marriage is really possible to sustain a good sex life, not something that peters out or just becomes very flat? And I guess the other part to that question would be, if so, what would you see as, other than good communication, what would you see as necessary to making that happen?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, and I'm asking this because a lot of people believe that, you know what, inevitably it's downhill once you get married. And the sameness, the routine, the repeated exposure to a partner, it just really kills a lot of desire and a lot of romance and passion. And I'm wondering, what's your experience with that?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The research on marital satisfaction, sexual satisfaction, is actually pretty high for people in long-term relationships. And that satisfaction is different from the description of sex that sounds exciting to somebody in the first stage of a relationship. And it's kind of a surprise for people. But if you think about it, you know, what are some of the building blocks of a good emotional and sexual relationship? It has to do with, you know, consent, trust, respect, you know, good communication, as you're talking about, a sense of safety, where a person can be more fully themselves, can be more expressive of themselves, and can fully receive. There aren't, you know, elements of fear and so forth that are part of it. Mm-hmm. But it does take some working at it, as you can imagine. There's this notion of the domestication of desire that happens in long-term relationships, where for a lot of people, what makes sex exciting is, you know, it's a little bit of risk, a little insecurity. There's a lot of novelty.
Yeah, you know, longing.
Yeah.
Mystery.
All that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets lost over time for most people. But they have these other elements of security and predictability in a nice sense.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of comfort. So over time, it might look like you're in kind of a lackluster relationship, doing the same old sexually. But actually, it can be very freeing for a lot of people. They can relax into it a lot more, and it actually can feel more satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
There are trade-offs there. You know, how do you think about this? A relationship, a longer-term relationship, does not look and act the same way as a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we make a big mistake by judging longer-term relationships by, current media presentations or, you know, beginning love sex.
Yeah, so people really need to be. Yeah,
they.
It sounds like people need to be kind of clear and informed and aware of what the whole timeline of a long-term relationship looks like. That you cannot stay in the initial stages of lust and longing and courtship and all the hormones that go along with that and the intensity that goes along with that. That inevitably you're going to settle into something that feels calmer and something that feels more predictable. And it sounds like you're saying that if people need to be able to relinquish some of those expectations that Hollywood puts on people about it having to be wild and woolly and intense and mysterious and all those things that get so applauded by Hollywood, so, you know, elevated by Hollywood, that people have to let go of that.
Absolutely. I think you're hitting on a fundamental point here, Susan, that a sexual relationship is a very particular individual relationship. And when it's between consenting adults, each person has full license to negotiate whatever is right for them and work that out with the partner, what's right for the partner. That's enough of a wrangle, figuring out how
mm-hmm.
to do something mutual with people who are different and might have different ideas and need to be educated in some ways, need to be brought along, helped out, supported.
Mm-hmm.
There's all that going on, but there's such freedom in these long-term adult relationships for people to forget all the external standards, what's really right for me, what's really right for us. At this point in our lives, might not be the same 10 years from now or 20 years from now, but let's figure out what's right for us right now, and let's
mm-hmm.
do that.
Okay, so one of the enormous benefits is the mutuality, the safety and the mutuality that happens over time. But it sounds like you're saying in order for it to be very intimate and satisfying, it's predicated on two people having a voice, which makes me think about a number of the women I work with where they're servicing their husbands just to shut them up and get them off their back. And
it doesn't only go that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, where it's really just throwing them a bone. And I don't know in my experience where I've ever seen that as turning into anything positive.
No. No, and it's really not giving their partner what I presume it's he, what he wants, whoever the partner is. Usually, you know, men get a really bad rap in all this. When you talk with men more fully about it, what they really want is to feel loved, to feel wanted, to feel desired, to feel that they're special, that somebody on this earth really cares about them, and they experience that most fully sexually. Not to make too broad a stereotype, not every man is the same.
Yeah. And that comes up in my work a lot, how the pathways to connection are so different often for men and women, that often the pathway to a sense of connection for men is through sex and sexual intimacy. And for women, women need to feel the connection through the context. They need to have feel like they're considered, to have conversation, to have affection, concern, acts of service. They need all those things often in order to be freed up to feel sexual.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge dilemma. I hadn't even thought of asking you that question and how you manage that.
Well, that's the balance that people need to work out in a relationship, that there's enough positive emotional connection going on that the female partner feels sufficiently engaged to want to do the sexual connection that will help her partner feel satisfied in life and want then to do more of the emotional connection. You know, so you get a positive dynamic going on there that is powerful. Then sex becomes a signal for whether they're doing enough of the emotional stuff in the relationship. So when the sexual frequency falls off or the quality falls off, then they need to look at, gee, we're probably not attending to the emotional connectedness part.
That's I think that's a very good thing to let couples know, that to, instead of having that become the source of somebody accusing the other of having something wrong with them or what's the matter with you, to instead really honor it as a signal of, well, obviously the context is not right, that we're not doing the rest, the other parts of the work that are necessary for us both to feel close, and to heed it as handwriting on the wall of some kind.
Yeah, and it may be that actually the male partner is feeling that the female really isn't emotionally present, that, you know, she's servicing him or something or other like that. So he's feeling unloved, he's feeling resentful, so he's not giving in the emotional area the way that she needs. You know, that couple has a negative spiral going on that's going to drag them down. But yeah, if they can just see there are these two big areas of their lives, if they can figure out how to balance that, to get enough good stuff happening in each person's, you know, primary area, it keeps the whole thing balanced really nicely.
Yeah. One book that I recommend to couples along those lines, to really look at how you do the balance and how you each, how partners need to help the other partner feel loved and valued so that you will be more intimate, you will feel more connected, is The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman, because often people feel that they're doing the work of emotional connection, but they're not speaking the right language. And, you know, that's another whole show, but that people really seem to relate to that that's a way of tuning in to, how do I tune into my partner in a way that's really meaningful for them, so that we're building intimacy, and the kind of intimacy that's conducive to sexual satisfaction also. One question I have for you, and I'm sure there are a number of listeners who would wonder about this, is, as a sex therapist, do you believe that sometimes spouses are just incompatible?
I do. There's a lot of luck that goes into whether relationships work out. And one of the pieces of luck is this physical comfort with each other, where your bodies fit together comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
You're not all elbows with each other.
Mm-hmm.
One guy, he was complaining. You know, he loved his wife, but he never felt like he could really get close to her. Every time he tried to get close to her in bed, for example, he would get an elbow or a sharp knee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was unendingly frustrating for him. The person's body smell, being
mm-hmm.
close to them, and having that be a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at them and finding what they see be appealing. That whole attraction is complicated. It's so individual. And, boy, it's hard to get around that if you don't have it.
So you're saying that in your experience that sometimes it's just not a good fit, the way people move, the way, you know, what their smell. I would think sometimes the way people feel to each other, the feel of their skin, if you cannot relate to whether somebody just doesn't feel right to you, or I would imagine sizes, if somebody is enormous and somebody is teeny, it sounds like in your experience it just may not be a good fit.
Yeah, or it makes it much harder.
Mm-hmm.
if that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
It
yeah.
makes it a whole lot easier in life if there is real attraction, if people mm-hmm. really fall in love, if they make a choice to be in relationship with this person, at that having that foundation, you know, if they've melded together through some heat of passion at the beginning, that's just such a big help
mm-hmm.
down the road.
Mm-hmm.
If people don't have that, it just makes it harder.
That doesn't
mean they can't continue on a relationship, but
mm-hmm.
you know, it just means you know, they have to work harder to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that gets to another question that it's a sort of a side question. Do you believe, let's say a couple just doesn't jive like that, either right in the beginning or early on, it just is not a good fit, and they're very klutzy with each other, and or they're not sensitized to, they're sensitized to something else that's arousing, maybe a partner who's been much more playful or more aggressive or somebody who feels very different. Do you believe, let's say, you know, I've worked with a lot of couples who just kind of give up and they're not having any sex because it didn't work early on or it just stopped working. Do you believe that couples can have a good marriage if it's a sexless marriage?
Absolutely. Yeah, I see it all the time. You know, there are over 40 million Americans who have sex less than 10 times a year.
I can believe that from my work. I've learned
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for those who struggle with various incompatibilities, it doesn't mean they have to throw in the towel on the whole relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Usually people stay married because there are a lot of other wonderful things going
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
in the relationship that are powerful, that are
mm-hmm.
important. And sometimes sex isn't going to work out with them. And sometimes it just needs a lot more attention. You know, is it really true that they can't develop a love language that's going to work for them? You know, have they really invested time in learning about their sexuality, talking about what might be possible? I love the... Sinclair Institute has a series of videos. There are several sets now, but the Better Sex videos and Extraordinary Sex and so on and so forth. If people aren't having good sex, and part of it has to do with technique or some kind of incompatibility. Just watching how other couples who aren't, you know, sensationalized Hollywood media image folks, how they go about it can give them some basis for making some changes in their own relationship.
Okay, so some of this can be, it sounds like, with time and patience, it can be learned.
Yeah, it's like, people with different financial orientations. Mm-hmm. They have to figure out how to get along in the same marriage, or people who like different kinds of foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're vegan and your husband's a meat eater, you have to work that out.
Yeah.
The same is true with sex. It is just another part of life.
Right. I encourage couples to be curious with each other around any differences, but around this difference too, especially to be curious, to not to kind of dispel the myth that either you get it and it's perfect chemistry from square one, or you're out of luck.
Right.
But instead to think of it as, well, maybe this is something that can be, you can kind of learn to dance together this way.
Yes.
It, maybe with time and curiosity about what you each need, it can be better and it can be much more satisfying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, there's something I see in my practice a lot, and it often feels really hopeless when people encounter it. It's, and I'm wondering, in your experience, after ruling out any physiologic problems, what do you feel, if anything, can be done if a spouse, and in my experience it's usually the wife, completely loses sexual desire or attraction, and she's just kind of shut off, and the husband is not, he still is interested in the wife, but the wife has absolutely no interest?
Well, I'd want to explore where that came from. When did she notice it first happening?
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that there's no physiologic base? You know, did it happen around the birth of the first couple of children?
Mm-hmm.
Is it part of their relationship? You know, is this a result of years of anger and resentments?
Mm-hmm. I see that a lot, yeah.
I mean, resentments are the worst desire killers,
mm-hmm.
Worse than low hormone levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing that I would want to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. And I think we both work with couples where one person never developed any kind of experience of their own sexuality, any language around their sexuality. They just, it was a, just an undeveloped part of themselves.
Yes.
So where that one person entered a marriage with no real desire. Maybe they accommodated a spouse early on, but they then went, they defaulted back to their original posture of not being interested or curious or having any desire. And I'm wondering, what would you say about that? Somebody who's maybe just very unfamiliar with their own sexuality, so they just, they don't experience any kind of desire.
Yeah, and there's often two groups of people who have that. One is the family that didn't touch a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole language of love, the physical affection, they didn't get that foundation in their families. So
mm-hmm.
it's really like learning a whole new language. It's very hard for people, and I think we have to respect how difficult that is, thinking of, you know, learning a whole new language that you're supposed to already know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the whole group of people who didn't know, didn't, well, we live in such a screwy language, a culture as far as sex anyway, but the communication that sex is a valued and important part of life often gets screwed up. It doesn't get properly transmitted to a young person, so that as she develops her sense of self, there's no place for sex in there at all, or there's a negative view attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So then when these people get in marriages, they know theoretically that they're going to be sexually active.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really compute at a more visceral level. And so that can be very challenging
mm-hmm.
for them. And I think they're able to make progress with it only if there's a really strong love.
Yeah, because there has to be, I think you're right, there has to be, in order for that person to be motivated to develop that,
yeah.
they need to not only understand theoretically this would be good for the marriage, but there needs to be a very strong motivation to be closer to the spouse in this way, because they love the spouse. What I've experienced
yeah.
is, a partner, and it's men, it's usually women, but there have been some men also who have said, well, if I've never felt it, I don't know what I'm missing. So how can I miss something that I've never had?
Exactly.
It's purely like theoretical for me. So
yeah.
then the question becomes, what's the motivation other than making the partner happy?
Yeah.
It's just not who I am. I hear that.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
not who I am. So why should I change?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
well,
sad.
That goes to the quality of the relationship and their view of themselves in the relationship. And you hope that they have regard for their partner.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you have to have the partner come in and talk very explicitly about how they feel about being alone in their body and not feeling loved in a way they can really feel it.
Mm-hmm.
What it means not to have the male part of them recognized, acknowledged, and loved. That's a terrible feeling. So,
yeah.
so, you know, try to up the ante a little bit by having men learn how to express their longing and their desire to be loved in this physical way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What it is they feel they're missing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of sadness about it for couples, a lot.
Absolutely.
Now, what about the whole issue of extreme differences in sexual appetite between mm-hmm. spouses? And I'm wondering, I've encountered this with some frequency, where one spouse felt just plagued by the other spouse. It felt like a constant assault, even if
yeah.
the other spouse did a pretty good job of trying to warm them up and invite them, that it became intolerable. Mm-hmm. And the spouse who had the higher libido often felt very humiliated and horny all the time, and just kind of shamed by feeling like they had to beg. And I'm wondering, what do you do when you encounter this problem with couples, just very different levels of libido and appetite?
Well, they have to have a series of really serious conversations, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
There's no magic bullet here, and it doesn't work for either person to get their way 100% of the time. they have to figure out an honest compromise that's going to work for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a middle ground.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, do they play let's make a deal time? Or what do they do to get the partner to be more cooperative? You know, whichever way you go. And it needs to be at the genuine level of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. It can be a problem, though. I remember
Absolutely.
Years ago working with one couple where the husband wanted to have sex two or three times a day, and the wife was happy with once a month. Mm-hmm. And she was beginning to feel assaulted by him.
Oh, yeah.
And he felt so rebuffed. It was so shaming for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that we explored was, well, could part of the accommodation on his level be a willingness to legitimize more masturbation so that he could relieve himself at least some mm-hmm. of the time.
Sure.
And I remember him being very, very angry about that. Why should I have to masturbate when I have a wife? You know, it's a part of what you're dealing
sure.
with, some entitlements here, but
yeah.
I'm talking where it's really, they're on opposite ends of the spectrum as far
yeah.
as interest and desire.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's helpful sometimes to break down what it is that the person who wants more sexual engagement, what they're really after. You know,
mm-hmm.
is it more skin contact? Is it, you know, some kind of contact? Is it attention?
Mm-hmm.
What makes up this sexual desire? What is it they're after? Can we break it down into some pieces that maybe the less interested spouse could provide more of some of those elements
mm-hmm.
Without having to do the whole intercourse thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And similarly with her not being as interested, if she's the one who's less interested,
yeah. Yeah.
Breaking down her resistance or you know, getting more cooperation really on how to
mm-hmm.
meet the other partner halfway.
Right. So looking at, it sounds like you're saying couples really need to look at good sex as being on a continuum, and that it doesn't have to be the whole shebang every time, but that one partner really may be seeking more skin contact or to cuddle or just to be caressed or just to have the warmth of someone's body near them. For couples not to presume that it has to be the whole shebang full to orgasm every time,
mm-hmm.
that's not always what they're wanting or needing.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it is very complicated, and you know, it varies from couple to couple. But this is one of the huge issues, these discrepancies in desire levels.
Yeah.
And people treat them like they're sacrosanct, too, that they're
mm-hmm.
not going to change over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the person who has the higher level of desire also has to learn to modulate that desire in
mm-hmm.
some way. If it's becoming a huge relationship problem, and similarly, the one who's not as interested, they can see how they're hurting their partner. You know, it's that partner involvement, concern, caring,
mm-hmm.
That becomes the huge issue. It's not actually the difference in sex, but you're not caring about me by
mm-hmm.
acting in this way.
Right, and it ends up becoming a power issue.
Oh, yes.
One person feeling controlled by the other person's the other person's desires or lack of desires, and then it gets really complicated. Would you, Judy, would you ever advocate that the low desire partner just give their partner mercy sex and do it just out of the spirit of love and not think of it as selling themselves out?
Yes, if it's in a context of overall give and take, that there's enough other times that person would be able to have more full participation. It can't always be mercy sex, as that doesn't feel good to either party.
Mm-hmm.
But from time to time, you know, take
mm-hmm.
one for the team, you know.
Right, okay. It's like making hot dogs or hamburgers for dinner instead of steak. You know, sometimes it's okay.
That's where that longer-term perspective can be helpful. Okay,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so you're not into it this time for yourself. But as a good team player, you know, you do this. And then next time your partner doesn't want to go to some social event that you really want to go to, or family event or something, rather, you could say, hey, buddy, you know, time for you to take one for the team.
you know, one hand rubs the other here, really.
Sure does.
Yeah. Now, I worked with one couple a long time ago where the husband was very had a very high libido, and he was absolutely hugely morbidly obese, and not really attractively really heavy, where he had muscles and he had some kind of shape, because that can happen too, but morbidly obese. He looked sort of like Jabba the Hutt. He was really unsightly, and he was very, very demanding of his wife, who was quite small. She was normal size, and it hadn't always been that way. He had kind of allowed himself to just kind of go to hell physically over the years. And I remember her talking at length about that. How could you expect me to want to make love to you and be with you if you don't take care of yourself? And I'm wondering, where do you see the whole issue of self-care in this, in the whole sexual dynamic? Does it feel, in other words, fair for you to hear one spouse say to the other, you know what, you want to be sexual with me, you want me to be available to you, then the least you can do is get yourself in some decent shape that would be attractive to me? Or does that just feel like it's mean-spirited?
No, that's legitimate. The same with hygiene issues.
Mm-hmm.
Other particular behaviors that are real turnoffs. You know, we have to have sincere regard for our partners if we expect them to open up to us in this personal sexual way. You know, there's got to be this real, you know, sincere regard for each other. But also, you're pointing out there needs to be sincere regard for oneself,
mm-hmm.
caring for oneself. How can you ask somebody else to care for you if you're not doing a basic job
mm-hmm.
Yourself? Mm-hmm. And that's quite a bind for the partner to be in. Jeez. You know, when you care about the person, but they're not caring about themselves enough to take care of themselves physically, I mean, that has major health ramifications.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, you know, it gets
diabetes,
experienced.
And heart problems. And,
oh, sure. Plus, it's it gets experienced as profound entitlement. You want a full sex life, but you don't do the basic self-care that would make you at all attractive, or that would, you know, how can you really fully love somebody who doesn't have self-love? So I think it, in my experience, it's toxic when you see it. I'm mindful of time here. We only have 12 minutes, but there's one question. It comes up in my work, and I'm sure you've seen it in your work with more familiarity, the whole issue of porn. And what about porn? If in your experience, if it's not secretive, if one partner says, and it's always the man, I don't know if I've ever seen it go the other way, I look at porn, it's my prerogative. Let's say it's not secretive. It's not something that's done either in a secretive or in a completely inappropriate environment, like in the middle of the family room when the kids are there. Would you view it as an individual form of fantasy and none of the other person's business, or would you see it as a type of infidelity?
Well, I'd want to talk with the person at length about all that. Yeah, if it truly is not interfering in the relationship or taking up time from other significant roles the person is involved in,
mm-hmm.
It can indeed be an expression and a feeding of the person's individual sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly men are different from women, and it's very hard for women to understand how visual men are.
Mm-hmm. Women get revolted by it. Yeah,
absolutely.
They get revolted by it. They don't understand it. And I've worked with women who completely flip out when they find out that their husband And even if he says, you knew about it, I told you about that years ago, they get so revolted, and it's a real problem. And then the whole issue.
So when that starts happening, then mm-hmm. it's a relationship issue, and the man needs to reevaluate his pornography use.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the couple dynamic then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much is he using it? And is he using as opposed to from time to time enjoying it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
Has it become more of an addiction?
Yeah. Do you see this a lot in your practice?
Oh, yeah.
Where? And now it's the internet.
Yeah.
Porn.
Yeah,
I think
so
it was
easy.
Different in the days when it used to be. Men would read Penthouse or Play,
yeah.
you know, Playboy, and it seemed more contained. I think in my experience, part of what complicates it, because it's not just the viewing. Now it's very connected to contact.
Mm-hmm.
And when does the viewing become something that's interactive, and it becomes now it's a kind of outside relationship?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. But I've seen women that they get so revolted that their husband could get aroused by this, that they have so many issues on a political level and on a, mm-hmm. A social level. It subjugates women, blah, blah, blah. And how could you do this? And I work real hard not to let my own biases kind of enter mm-hmm. the picture. About,
yeah, it is so easy for men. How could you? Well, it's very
yeah.
easy for them.
Very. And you look at the man in the room will look at you, and it's clear that they know that maybe their wife will never get it, that it
yeah.
has nothing to do with cheating or anything else. And do you build that into your work as a sex therapist, the whole notion of certain types of solo sexual activity like that? That you try to legitimize in the work?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can think about it from an evolutionary perspective that men are hardwired to be visually oriented sexually, to
mm-hmm.
perceive those sexual signals.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you know, we can't blame them for how they're wired.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that, and men have to understand, okay, because I'm wired that way doesn't necessarily mean that some of that can't be overridden by higher cognitive functions,
mm-hmm.
You know, that they have to make some decisions about whether this is causing too much pain in
mm-hmm.
their relationship. It's quite a calculation. But, yeah, all of those things, the web has just been wonderful for all kinds of sexual minorities,
mm-hmm.
sexual practices, people who have felt alone, isolated, you know, nobody else is weird the way that they are, and they go online and find that there's a whole community of people
mm-hmm.
like themselves, and, you know, so they can feel more affirmed in their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
This too is another aspect of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sense of community that can be experienced. So it sounds like what you're saying is, with this as with a lot of other issues, that what's key for a good sex life and a growthful, satisfying, mutually satisfying sex life, that it's key that there be ongoing negotiations, that there be voice on each end, that there be empathy and curiosity, that when those things are there and people are motivated by those things, that there'll be less positioning around differences.
Yeah. Absolutely. You're very good, Susan. you summarize a lot in that sentence. Yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds like that, you know, that's really what you're saying, that I guess the key to a really good sex life, if you're going to be married and stay married and have hopes for having a good sex life, is you need to talk to each other, you need to be curious, you need to have empathy. It sounds like you're saying you need to be appreciative of differences and not be clones of each other, just to recognize that you're not two peas in a pod. And it sounds like you're also saying be patient, that a lot of these things just take time. They're very affected by life stage.
Yeah.
And we haven't even talked about physiology, aging, and all that stuff. That could be another whole show, Judy. But sounds like you're saying patience and a learning curve, that those are really critical things.
One of the main benefits, I think, of being in a long-term relationship is that it is the closest you get to being another person.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, our partners persist in doing these wrong things despite our good advice. And when we finally grasp that they're doing that because that's really who they are, and it's not going to change.
Right.
We come around to this point of, well, you know, I don't think that's right, but they do. So that's normal, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like me. It's truly different. And we don't get how different we are until we've been in a long-term relationship.
Mm-hmm.
How these differences are not going to go away just by, you know, being nicer, more polite, or like the other person. They don't go away. They persist. And you have to find some way of accepting that at some fundamental level and being willing to work with it.
Yes. Yeah.
It's
I think you just put it in a nutshell. I think in my experience also as a couples therapist, that's it in a nutshell, just kind of accepting, being more accepting of the fact that you're not two peas in the pod and being more respectful around that and not making a project of making your spouse be more like yourself. I think you're absolutely right. Now, Judy, do you believe it? It's 9:57. It went like lightning.
Have you hugged your cat today or what are you saying?
It went like lightning, and there nobody had any questions. There are several listeners on the line, but I have a feeling, Judy, that there may be a call for another show because there's so many issues related to this. And I'm wondering if you would want to do that with me at any future point.
Oh, absolutely! You're great to have a conversation with Susan.
Yeah, we should do this more often.
Exciting topic.
Yeah. Well, so, Judy, thank you so much for coming on and being my guest and sharing all your wisdom with our listeners. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure other people have. And I'm wondering, how could people contact you for either couples therapy or sex therapy? Should they just call your office number or what?
Yep, they can do that, and they can go on the ASEC website, www.aasect.org. Type in sex therapist, and there'll be a map, and then go to New Hampshire, and they can see a web page describing all my, you know, background qualifications and so on and so forth, my orientation and contact information.
Okay, that's great. So the phone number, your number is 603-773-0190, and the website is www.asec.org.
Right.
Well, Judy, thank you so much. I'm going to have to sign off. I think you really shed a lot of light on a lot of things. And I hope you have a good summer. I know you're a great gardener. So thank you so much again.
Okay. Yeah, good loving everybody.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Now, thanks to all you listeners also for tuning in. And tune into my next show Wednesday, June 29th at 9 p.m. I will be talking about how to avoid common communication problems in relationships, the seven things every couple should do to stay out of trouble and get on the right track. Be demystifying some of the questions people have about communication, which is such a central thing in all relationships. So stay tuned. That's Wednesday, June 29th at 9 p.m. All right. Take care, everybody. I hope you enjoy the next few weeks, the early weeks of summer. And we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.